Welcome to the Cheltenham School Board Meeting Podcast, online at www.cheltenhamlocal.org or at www.cheltenham.fm.
Cheltenham School Podcast. Facilities Committee Meeting. Part 1 of 2 Parts. March 5, 2019.
Thank you. And then you have the minutes from the February 5th meeting, if people want to take a moment to review those. Any comments, proposed changes? If not, I'll take those as being approved. Thank you.
I continue to feel like our minutes need to be more substantive.
Who takes the minutes? I mean, that's for facilities.
Yes. As there's, unlike the board meeting that's not recorded, to put verbatim what my opinion is on this and not have anything to balance on, that is why they're kept the way that they are. That is how we've always kept up. Because then it is what my interpretation is on what public comment is. It's not memorialized in any type of recording. So that's why the minutes are the way they are.
Somebody reviews them, right?
We vote on them, so that is an opportunity for us to
say this is your.
That's it.
Yeah. There's a check and balance there of fact.
There are, and they're circulated.
They're circulated actually to the board before this meeting.
Right.
And then we have a chance to approve them at this meeting. And then they get approved, or they're not approved at the legislative meeting, but they're approved at the board committee.
So my point is anything that would have made it into the minutes that the board in full doesn't agree with, it doesn't feel like what happened would be caught at several points.
Right, and remember at
to help us guard against there being just opinion rather than fact.
Right, and remember at the legislative meeting also the chair of that committee will be reporting out to the entire community on the meeting itself, which is much richer than the minutes from the meeting. So it's an opportunity to enhance what's already part of the meeting.
I'm not going to fall on a judge's mic. But I do feel like nobody comes to the legislative meetings, and people do have an opportunity to read these things as they're posted online. And so if we really are interested in transparency around what happens in these meetings, other than, hey, you're welcome to come, we have 1,000 meetings, I continue to feel that a depth and breadth is
who's doing it right?
Who's doing it right?
Yeah.
That's a good question to ask.
Other school districts?
Yes.
I don't know.
So one of the conversations that could happen in communications and the communications agenda is to say we want to explore school districts' minutes to come up with a framework of what we would like to recommend as a communications committee moving forward. Then we present that to the board. The extent in which, obviously, no one's transcribing word for word, I'm sure they're not in that instance.
Right.
So they're pulling nuggets of it. So maybe that could be exploratory. Whatever the agenda items are for the next couple of months, maybe we can add that and say, Kevin/Varone, can you investigate and see what those minutes look like? Pull together and say, it appears that schools have a really rich follow-up and they tend to have these categories. To what extent do we want to do that? Also, I want to share with you that oftentimes it is not the administrative chair that takes the notes. It is one of the chairs of the committee who does that. But so I wouldn't mind exploring that. I don't know who does it right in terms of what we think is the best way to do it, because sometimes it can go, if we do it, it can go into 11, 12, 13, 14 pages, or we just get a truncated version. But I do think there needs to be a balance where what we have may not speak to all the conversation we have.
And we may not want to work that at the table. I think it's a good recommendation to take it back to the communications committee and ask for, review a sample frameworks for minutes as a way to bring back the recommendation to the board.
Thank you very much. That was lovely.
8 months.
Yeah.
Cool.
And in terms of my minutes for the minute conversation, that was reflected in my notes. my formal minutes as a
commissioner.
We'll be sharing at the board meeting. Okay, to move on. Right. So we have an enrollment study presentation by Dan Farina of Montgomery County Planning Commission. I've had the fortune of seeing Dan present a number of times at the Planning Commission. And he'll be talking about enrollment study and some of the work that's been done and some of the changes that the county and Dan have identified in terms of demographics and enrollment projections, looking backwards, but also a little bit forward. So, please.
Here, let me, I'll give out the copies.
We'll
get any
extra back.
You're fine.
Are we actually pulling up, are we actually trying to pull up a presentation?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. We can wait.
There are 20 copies there, so everybody's your mark.
Is that progress?
Okay, so system on.
There you go.
System on. Okay.
There we go.
There, it's green.
You see something?
Yes. Is there?
Pam, while we're waiting, I know we were sent a copy of this study electronically, so you may want to pull that up.
I fixed it.
Our copy.
The light is dull by blinking lights.
Yes, I might just see something.
Okay.
The light's on the projector.
Yeah, it's green.
Well, literally everyone in the room does have a copy, so.
Yeah, if we have to, I can always just go through the book, you know, paper. You know, actually, yeah, maybe. Maybe not all the color.
Giving us all $50.
There we go.
All right.
Yes. Yeah, it's going right now. Sorry. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Well, I did fix it. Right
there. Okay, so thanks for bearing with us, and we're ready to start.
Hi, my name is Dan Farina. I'm a county planner at the Montgomery County Planning Commission, and I work under Scott France, who manages the school enrollment projection program that we have. I was charged with doing the Cheltenham initially, as well as the update. this is one of the many, many things that the county does. We've, I think, so far done around 14 districts within Montgomery County, and we've done a number of updates for those districts as well. So I'll just get started. So MCPC completed the original study in November 2016. At that time, the preferred alternative, which was option three, that option three included a higher birth adjustment of about 9 more births each year, as well as a housing adjustment that accounted for a number of developments that were undergoing, as well as still to get started within the municipality. So at that point, we had projected 391 more students for the district between 2016 and 2026. The factors that affected that original growth trend that we observed were a marked increase in the number of students originating from multifamily apartments, historically large elementary school classes, a decrease in private school enrollment, an increase in students due to housing sales, what we call housing churn, housing construction, as well as a demographic growth in young families within the district. However, growth seen between 2009 and 2016, which is the primary growth period for the district before within the CSD, basically reversed the last 2 years, and there was a loss of around 340 students since the original study. The original study did project that the first year out would have a slight decrease and then start to rebound after that, but we are well beyond around 5% difference from where the original projection was, which is not really acceptable by our standard. This is the first district that we've actually had such a dramatic shift in where the projection went, and I'll explain why. So, like I said, many of the school districts, specifically in the eastern half of Montgomery County, are currently experiencing growth in their enrollment, or are poised to experience growth. Abington, Lower Merion, and Springfield have all seen a growth dynamic. But several factors are affecting Cheltenham to have a pretty opposite enrollment dynamic. Number one, I think, is one of the more interesting ones, that private school enrollment has likely actually been increasing over the last few years alone. The U.S. Census, and I'll go more into depth of that, has reported that there's a higher percentage of school-age children who live within the district that are going to private school again. And we'll discuss where that came from versus where it was the last time we did the study. Cheltenham is also mature, fully built out in a ring-serving community with few large-scale development opportunities remaining. Ashbourne Meadows, which was one of the largest ones, is getting underway this summer. Wingate at the old Cedar Brook Country Club is also one that's finished up. And then Melrose Country Club would be the only other large parcel that might come on the market for something like residential development going forward. There's also been less public school students originating out of existing multifamily developments. This is probably the most stark retreat we've seen in this trend, because most districts we've been seeing a growth in this, or a stability at this point. Cheltenham has seen a pretty big decrease since the last time we measured this, not really like that. You also have a number of aging facilities and requisite construction projects, so that kind of flux can also affect enrollment in a number of different ways. There have been much smaller elementary school classes replacing the historically large ones that we saw about 3-4 years ago. And then the one thing that hasn't really changed, and it probably is the one thing that gives you a net benefit or actually affects positively your growth, is the home sales. They continue to increase, and they also are continuing to provide students a net gain of students to the district. So that acts as a counterbalance to some of these other things that we're seeing. So just looking at the enrollment history, I mean, this graph pretty much shows where most of your decline happened as well. It was mainly in the elementary school and pretty much in the last year. But also the high school has been steadily declining to the last few years after slightly rebounding in 2016-17. Based on the original model saw only a steady period of growth. So all the progression rates, all the numbers we had were indicating that there was going to be a slight, continued growth pattern. That became a stable figure essentially in 2016-17, and then the next year started coming back down. What you will see though is that requisite K-4 decrease also corresponds with a slight increase in 5-6, which makes sense because those grades that were large are now moving into 5-6 in a couple years, or within the next year they'll move into 7-8, and that might inflate a bit, and then onto the high school. So how those classes progress and whether or not you lose more students or gain more students over that year will affect how big the bubble from elementary school affects the high school in the end. So this, I did this for your district to show you just how different the last year or two has been from your historical way of growth. So you can see all red squares are years where the enrollment went down from the previous grade year. So the fourth grade class in 2011 12 was the third grade class in 2010-11, and that was a net a growth. So, they
so
have
we got to look at the diagonal?
Yeah, yes, yes. So essentially, each class would be a capacity, you know, diagonal down to the end. So in just high school always has generally in your district had a kind of lost, you know, thrust to it. Like they typically lose students from 9th through 12th grade. The years where you've gained are outliers. 6th and 5th through 7th through 8th is often, you know, growth or decline. It's not necessarily one or the other, but your elementary grades have always consistently usually grown year to year. Some years by pretty large amounts, and I think up to about like 3 or 4 years ago, you were seeing pretty large jumps, especially even in your larger classes that you already had. But this, you can see clearly that in the last year alone, bless you, every single class year actually declined, which, again, I couldn't really tell you specifically what did that. That seems that's a very stark shift we've never seen in another district, a true about face. So it is. I just did this so that you can see just how different the last year in terms of enrollment, you know, growth it really was. And those numbers below the last line are the decrease in number of students from the previous year. So the largest decrease took place between 9th and 10th grade. Of 51 student loss.
I don't know if you're going to touch upon this moving forward, but just one of the conversations that we had was the data that Dan used is October 1st data. So it was October, and it's apples to apples to apples.
Yeah.
One of the things that we saw or that we notated was our October 1st enrollment is lower than where our enrollment is right now. So we gained students after that time period. So at October 1st, that's what it's reflecting and seeing that difference. So to a degree, I don't want everybody panicking saying we lost all these students because our enrollment at October 1st was about 4313. It's over 45 right now. So along the way, we also, which is an enigma a little bit, enrollment is happening after that October 1st period, so we're gaining students as well. So it's kind of balancing that out.
So I had shared with the board data that shows that, and I think it is anomaly, because no other place after October 11th gets so many students than we do in terms of that. And I'm wrestling with what that looks like and some of that. Why would a parent or parents decide to move their elementary child in December? And in December now we have 7 additional students at Glenside Elementary. It's not the type of transition that normally happens in terms of that. People kind of wait till the following year if they're coming in the middle of the school year, but Cheltenham has seen that, unlike other districts where there's stability, here after October 1st, we get a larger number, and we shared that preliminary with you in terms of what those numbers look like.
And I've noticed too, because we also use the end of year rosters to measure the sales movement, and I've noticed there can be a discrepancy between your October numbers and those too. So that might show that you have a significant amount of enrollment activity during the year. So we can talk a little bit more about that too at the end if you have any other questions. You can't really see it well on here, unfortunately, but I have highlighted in green on the bottom graph all of the class sizes that are above 100. And in this is Glenside, this is just one example. Glenside and Cheltenham, this is very much the dynamic, and they both lost a good amount of students in the last year. It's mainly pretty much because those few large classes that were between 2011 and 2014, every kindergarten came in nearly over 100, which is, I think, an anomaly in general for you, because I don't think in the history before that we really saw that as well. And those moved through. Sometimes they lost a little, but sometimes they gained. So some of those classes got even larger. And in the last year, they all moved out. All of them have been now moved into 5th and 6th, or are, you know, wherever. And you had no classes that came up that replaced that size. So you're going to see now, essentially, like in essence, that 480 or 485 peak that you had may have actually been kind of an anomaly. In the sense that these are atypical class sizes that you may not see very often unless you have some kind of baby boom or a big housing churn can feed that. But
one of the conversations we also had that he explained was as you're looking diagonal, you're seeing that those class sizes are relatively staying. So a big concern is if you saw in 13-14, you see the K class and you go diagonal, it's still staying over 100. So it's not like it's going from 110 down to 86, and we're losing kids at that rapid. So the bubble classes are staying. So they're moving through our district. And that's one of the indicators that he said it's strong to see that, you know, those cohort classes are staying strong.
And in the last couple of years, Elkins Park's enrollment has grown, I think, by around 30 or 40 students. So that makes sense, given that these classes are starting to move into there. So just look, we're going to look at some of the factors now that influence the projections. One would be the millennial generation impact. They're really starting to form more households now. They're starting to have more children. In general, though, they're having less children than the generation prior to them. They're also forming households later, and generally just household sizes are smaller. So even with the same amount of housing units, even if you were to build more housing units, house sizes are generally smaller. So it's not, doesn't have the same effect as it did, say, 30 or 40 years ago. But in the last couple of years, Cheltenham births have actually ticked up a little bit compared to where they were, say, 5 to 10 years ago. But in general, it trends along with the county. The county, we saw kind of a growth again from the low point in 2013 up until about 2015, and then it went flat, came back down a bit, and then it's been flat the last couple of years. This is kind of a phenomenon that's happening across the United States. No one can really give you a straight answer why. There's a lot of cultural reasons why that might happen, but either way, births are lower than they were a generation ago, and that will negatively impact enrollment growth. But another interesting bright spot is that the females aged 25 to 34 in Montgomery County are a growing demographic, and those are the prime child-rearing years. I'd also almost go so far as to add 35 to 39 in that at this point. I think when going forward, we will add that age group in because they're also having as many children as people age like 31 to 35, so it's not really that much of a difference anymore. Mm-hmm. So that figure would even be higher in that sense. I think this one might be one of the bigger determinants, and the only reason I say that is because I was surprised to see such a relative growth from 2010 to 2017 in private school enrollment. We're starting to see private school enrollment tick up in certain places, but not necessarily to this degree. And usually it still maintains the same percentage in private school. That doesn't usually go up, even if the numbers do go up in other districts. But because the district has lost some students, the increase in private school students likely attributed to the U.S. Census, you can see that it's raised the percentage. So you essentially lost 2% of the school-aged children in the district are now going to private school more so than they were public, you know, compared to 2010. These are five-year estimates, though. They're estimates of estimates, essentially, over a five-year period. So, of course, there's a margin of error. They're not one-to-one comparisons. So we also look at the private school enrollment records from the school district itself. Most school districts, I believe this is usually like private school busing, because you're obligated to bus private school students. So this isn't always the best indicator either. This shows a little bit of a decrease in the last couple years, but that doesn't mean that more parents aren't sending their kids to private school. It just means less are utilizing the school students' bus. I would, when this, in your case, I would look at the private school enrollment at the U.S. Census and say that that's more likely an indicator of where private school enrollment is going in the district based on just how much of a change it actually is.
So a question, if I may, mostly for the school district. When students attend private school, is there not a requirement that they have to register with the school district of parents that they're attending private school, or only if they're going to be availing themselves of the school district busing?
Yes, only when they're doing it with the busing.
Okay.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's usually how most districts we get it to. Yeah, most districts don't have a direct one, you know, definitive list. And then charter school enrollment has largely been around, you're playing the same 78 to 79 students on average every year, except for the anomaly in 2016-17 where there was a pretty stark decrease, but next year it shot back up. So this, but I also don't think that that's affecting enrollment any more than it did the last time we did the study.
Do you have any kind of measurement of homeschooling?
We typically do measure homeschooling, but I don't know if we have, do we have figures for the district? That's maybe more,
yeah.
Yeah, we didn't have a definitive figure, so I didn't include it. Some districts do keep that, some don't, so when they do, I include it. Yeah, no problem. And then now we'll talk about probably the most important ones, are the ones that most districts usually care the most about because it affects their enrollment more, most acutely, is the children that you get from new housing construction. Now, just in general, in Cheltenham, multifamily housing provides the fewest school-age children, while single-family detached and attached provide the most. This data comes, these ratios that we apply to any new developments to figure out how many students are likely to come from the development, are derived from a 2010 study that we did based on 2010 census data that looked at each of these housing types and how many children essentially lived in them. So this is a per unit, essentially, rate. And we found out at the county level that, you know, in new units, there's basically a one-to-one for single-family detached. If you build one single-family detached unit, you're likely going to get at least one student. If you build a single-family attached unit, about one in every five of those units will have a child. If you build a new multifamily unit, one in every 20 will. So in a 100-unit building, you know, maybe you'll have five students. So that's usually, like, people get really upset about multifamily buildings, but they usually contribute the least amount, and they usually contribute more tax money than they would if they had, like, a more robust amount of students. But anyway, unfortunately, we can't get new ratios for Cheltenham because the study only looks at single blocks that have a single housing type in it. So census blocks are are one of the building blocks for how they measure data for the census. And so if a block, if a census block had a multifamily units and single family detached units on it, it doesn't count that, so we couldn't do that. So unless a multifamily development was its own census block, it really wasn't included in the study, so we couldn't get a ratio for that or any of the other new units, because you didn't build enough new units to between 2000 and 2010 to build a statistically significant sample. So we don't do that. So we usually come up with our own, and we have a rationale behind that. It's usually based on what we've observed either in other districts or in already built in recent developments within Cheltenham, and that's what we did here. But you can see, though, that the Cheltenham School District doesn't deviate too much from the county in terms of how many students come from the existing units, except for multifamily, which is more, and single-family attached, actually. And I think that's more just because that's a pretty dominant housing type in Cheltenham as well.
Can I ask a definitional question?
Sure.
When you say multifamily units, the denominator would be like the number of apartments?
Yeah, so it's any building that shares a common hallway and is more than two units, right? So, in other words, a stacked duplex isn't technically a multifamily unit. It's actually attached, but a quadplex that every door to an apartment opens up onto the same hallway would be considered a multifamily.
In that case, you're divided by four, though.
Yes.
Well, you know, one kid divided by four.
Yeah. So exactly. Yeah. So it's basically, so if a four-unit building has two kids come from it, it has a ratio of 0.5, right?
Can
students.
I ask if you could just continue your presentation?
Oh, sure.
And then
I'm sorry. Yeah.
The questions go to the board first,
yeah,
and then we'll go off to community.
No problem. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, this map didn't transfer right in this. I apologize, but this was only supposed to show me where the housing units are. And I can tell you that the only really housing units he built in the last 5 years have been Wingate, and those are in the bottom left, if you can't see them. But either way, there was an average of 31 units built over the last 5 years each year. That's excluding age-restricted. And it resulted in about seven students on average out of the district each year. That's the trend level of development, as we call it.
31 units?
Yeah. On average each year. So now we're going to look at housing potential. This is probably what you're most concerned about. This is what will likely get built and how will that affect your district and how we add it to the model. So the net impact of very likely future developments, which for Cheltenham over the next 5 years is only two, was an addition of 63 public students. So we spread that over each school year and each grade level. So that it's even. The two that are the most likely to happen are likely going to happen within the next couple of years are Ashbourne Meadows, which has been going through pre-construction for the last year and a half and is now getting ready this summer to start construction. So impact will likely be felt starting the 2020 school year as units start rolling on. It's a multi-phase development, though, so it's going to take a number of years for it to finish. Melrose Court Apartments are getting rehabbed a bit, and I think they're adding units inside. It's about 27 new multifamily units will be added there. Like I said, new multifamily units don't typically add, but that apartment complex is already more of an affordable one, so depending on how they price the units, it can provide more students maybe than you would expect. And then the other three are ones that could happen, may happen, or are just pointing out where you have large spaces where housing could go. So starting at the left would be Lab Rock Hill. I'm not going to go into the deep development limbo that Lab Rock Hill is in. I spent nearly an hour last week just reading court documents. But suffice it to say, it's likely to be age-restricted, and it's if it's built in the current way that it's proposed, and that's what the courts have said. So that will likely not affect that it's 260 multifamily units anyway. Enclave at Curlin Farm, that is going through as well. They have preliminary approval for those EDUs. There's 79 of them. I know that there was, anecdotally, I've heard that there's some local community concern about whether or not students would still originate from it, even though it's an age-restricted development. Chances are, though, even if they did, it would still be a very negligent amount, maybe a few students, really. It's not even that large of a multifamily development to begin with. And it also depends on how the owner of the property enforces the age restriction. So some places are more strict than others. And then, of course, the last one is Melrose Country Club, which is not for sale. No one's bought it yet. It's just a large parcel that I think has developer interest, and I think the interest is for housing and as opposed to like other forms of development, like industrial and commercial. So these are what are going to affect Melrose Court Apartments and Ashford Meadows, or what we believe that in the next couple of years will definitely affect the district. And then just looking at some other housing impacts, you can see that there's existing housing unit sales have shot right up and steadily growing, which is a good thing for the district in general, for Cheltenham's fiscal health. It's above where it was before the recession as well. Not quite where it was at the beginning, at the peak of the last housing boom, but still very healthy. And you can see on the right, the graph impact of housing units sold, that the number of students as a result of housing sales is a net gain for the time periods that we've looked at over the last 8 years. And then at the bottom is probably the more interesting one that I think has also had is an interesting effect and may actually be where a number of your students essentially are absent, you know, from the data in the early part of the year and may come in later, is in the multifamily. And what's interesting that, and especially actually Kara brought this up, was that we usually use the end of year rosters for this as well, but we couldn't for 18-19. We had to use the beginning of year roster because that's all that's, of course, available. So that is the one deviation, and that is possible that 799 might go up by the end of the year. It seems to be that likely is the case. As apartments are, of course, the easiest to move in and out of, especially for people who were, you know, moving in and out of the district. But in general, though, at the beginning of the year, it came back down to the ratio it was in 2009-10, which was the lower one that we've seen in the years that we've been doing this study. So it peaked in 2015-16 at 982 students originating, and a ratio of 0.2, so one in every five units, existing units had a child. But now it's slightly below the county average. So this could also be having an effect on your enrollment as well. And I can't speak to why there's so many less students essentially coming for multifamily. I can point out to you in the report, you can see for yourself which specific developments have lost a good amount, and Linwood Gardens, which is a significant contributor to the district, has lost a good amount of students as well in the last couple of years. So. And then now we'll move on finally to the projection. The projection method we use is the cohort progression method. It's the industry standard for projecting this type of survival from a cohort from a period to a period. So, you know, it just measures essentially whether, you know, how many students make it from first grade into second grade of the next year, essentially is what we're doing. And a ratio above one means that there was growth in that year from the prior year, and a ratio below one means that there was a decline or a decrease in the number of students. You can see at the bottom, we use a five-year average to project enrollment forward. 5 years is another pretty standard number to use, five or six. You can go less than that. The less that you go, essentially the less history you're basing a projection on. Now that can be beneficial if in a district like yours where you've seen such a stark change in just a short amount of time. If you wanted to extrapolate what that might look like if that continued, you can do that easily by having a shorter progression rate period. For the purposes of the study, I give you a three-year progression rate, and we'll talk about it, but I wouldn't recommend using that. That's not typical. It's not as robust. So we use the five-year average, and you can see at the bottom, those are the five-year averages that were used in the model. Now, what's interesting is that even though the last year registered all rates below one, balanced out with the previous 4 years, most of the elementary schools still post a gain, essentially, in students, or an average gain of students. So in the model, take that into account, elementary school is going to still be projected as gaining in the model. Whether or not that happens, of course, is based on the trajectory that the kindergartens have been having with lower enrollments. So the three scenarios I gave you, which when we do an update, we usually just update the preferred alternative or the recommended scenario that we recommend in the initial study. This one I decided to give you these three because I wanted you to see what a scenario based on a shorter progression rate average would be like, and what would the most drastic decline in students look like if it were to continue. And that's option two. Option one is the five-year progression rate without any future birth growth or housing construction accounting. And the second one is just the only difference is the three-year rate. Option three, which is the one that I would recommend because it's the most finely tuned, it's the most robust, it's the reason why you hire us, accounts for a slight increase in births. Based on the fact that Cheltenham has seen a slight increase in births last year, we gave you the benefit of the doubt. We added two new births each year to the estimate. As well as accounting for that construction impact beyond the trend level development. So essentially we don't, you know, count on what's already baked into the model, what's already been built more recently, and the students that come from that. So everything above that is what we factor into the model, and for this would be 63 students. So just a quick overview of one and two, just to show you the difference in the actual enrollment numbers that You know, so if you look at the first one, that's your standard five-year progression rate, flat first, no housing adjustment. You're likely essentially to kind of go sideways in terms of enrollment. Like, there's not much growth, not much decline from this point. This model seems to think that, you know, you will not or cannot go much lower than this. There is some decline in the second five-year period. The second five-year period of a progression model is always the least reliable because it doesn't have any of the housing adjustment in it and things like that. So you just take that with a grain of salt. But in the end, it brings you down, I think, about 40 students by the end of the 10-year period. If you're looking at option two, that's the three-year projection rate. That means that literally this projection is weighted towards the decline. The last 2 years were decline conditions, and the year before that was a peak. So the only growth year in that is the peak year. So that really heavily weights it down towards decline, and you can see that it results in a net loss of nearly 300 students after 10 years. Now, if you were to add a slight birth adjustment to that and add the housing adjustment to that, you would add about 75 students to that ending rate. So that's what it would be if you were to add all of option three's bells and whistles into that third. So know that you would probably have a little bit over 4,000 students at the end of that 10-year period. Here's the one that we suggest you take to heart. This is option three. If we broke it down into different grade levels, you can see more clearly what's growing and what doesn't. So in the first five-year period, elementary school and high school grow. Elementary school grows again in this model, mainly due to the housing adjustment and the birth adjustment. Well, actually, not so much the birth adjustment. The birth adjustment has a more greater effect in the second five-year period, because that's when those births affect the enrollment. But the housing instruction affects the first five-year period. So a lot, you can see that's what accounts for a lot of that elementary school growth. And then 9 through 12 grows over the next 5 years as a result of those 7, 8, 5, and 6 classes moving through the rest of the system. That elementary school bubble moving through the system will affect high school. Now, in the second five-year period, though, high school goes back down again and declines. And it will wind up having it will be one of the only few grade distributions that has a net decline at the end of 10 years, which is 80 students. 5 through 6 is expected to have a marginal net decline of 26 students. K through 4 should, in theory, grow again at the end of 10 years by 169, and 7 through 8 by 27 students. Again, the middle school years are always going to be kind of those years that are relatively stable because they're just collecting what you know is coming from the elementary school. Elementary and high school are probably your biggest outliers. And then if you look at this model, it's a 90-student net gain by the end of 10 years. So it's not a giant gain from where you're at now, but it's still a growth scenario. So just if you're accepting option three, general trends should provide for an increase of about 2% over the next 10 years, while the other options show mild to moderate decreases. The number of students coming from older apartment buildings has decreased in recent years. Private school enrollment has likely increased, and elementary school classes have been smaller. Housing construction is expected to outpace the recent trend level and bring additional growth. Several projects could add an additional 63 students above the trend development. Birth activity has been relatively low in recent years, but it could increase further as the millennial generation moves into childbearing years. This effect will not be as relevant to enrollment until the secondary period and beyond. Additional students are also resulting from an increase in housing sales activity still. So again, it's the one continuing, one thing that's a constant from the previous study in terms of conditions. But the things that, of course, we would recommend you keep looking at are the school calendar birth rates, the residential development and how that plays out and when it comes online, the sales activity, non-public school enrollment, and students in multifamily housing. Those are probably going to be the last two are probably the biggest reasons for the change that we believe that you've seen in the last couple of years compared to where the original model was. So that's it. I will take any questions.
Okay, thank you. We'll start with the board and we'll start down on this end.
I have no questions, thank you. I mean, other than you can confirm that this information lets us understand that our facilities won't need to expand or contract because we're basically flat.
As the model puts forth, yes. And again, even if you were to consider, say, what would get built, which could, again, be what drives growth in the district, again, it's still not going to result. It's not a 400-unit single-family attached development. It's not going to result in hundreds of new students. So, I mean, again, I can only provide the information. I can't make a decision for you. But yes, I would say that in general, you're not going to see probably 500-600 more students over the next, 10 years. That would be an outlier. That would be a dramatic shift, which wouldn't have been easy to foretell.
We have almost no place to put them, so that's not like
that's, yeah, that's so.
Thank you. That's all I have.
No problem.
I have a question around. So the assumptions around this are the 2% increase is based on the enrollment, the low enrollment. It's based on the current year's enrollment, correct?
Yeah, so that's the jumping off point for the study, right? So this is current year.
I guess what I'm trying to tease or understand what Ms. Michaels was saying around how that number may be lower than what it actually is, and if that's the case, are we actually looking at a different number or not?
Well, at the end of the year, you'll do your end of your roster. And I think whatever that brings back will show you how generally, and I would compare that to the last couple of years maybe, and see what generally or your average percentage deviation from your beginning year enrollment to your end year enrollment is. And maybe that could be something that you could find a way to factor into a model like this. You could, in theory, factor it into a model like this. It's a numerical value, so it can be grafted into it. That also can change, though. You know what I mean? I understand, I think what makes Chelyhan unique and why you might gain a lot more students over the year is your proximity to Philadelphia, the fact that it is has a complicated reputation as a school district, and that Cheltenham has a variety of relatively affordable housing options as well. So it makes it an easy stop for someone who's just trying to get out of the Philadelphia school district, specifically too in high school years and middle school years where the quality of schools in the city drops even further. Now, Abington also sees some of that overflow. They also see resident. I know we talked about residency enforcement and things like that. If you've increased residency enforcement too, that could also affect these numbers in a way that we wouldn't have accounted for in the original study. So there's all different things, and I think in a district like yours that has so many of these variables acting on it, as opposed to say like North Penn, which has a pretty standard suburban ebb and flow of enrollment, being a fairly built out single family detached mainly community, Cheltenham just does not sit in that place of the region to have that dynamic, and it does not have the type of housing stock that really is a barrier to that kind of transient movement.
And then as a board, Joel, you were saying that the primary use for this is I assume facilities and understanding the things around staffing and things like that. Is this also, think about when we're talking to community members who are saying, there's X hundred fewer enrollments, what does that mean? Sounds like we are now armed with some information about that isn't necessarily some reason to be alarmed about our district at all. This is sort of natural progression around how things ebb and flow. And yeah, it was an outlier, but
yeah.
I guess so I'm trying to get a sense of, are these numbers in districts in general not just used for planning purposes, but also used for reflection on district or health?
You can use these numbers to infer a lot about a district. Doesn't necessarily mean you're right. What I would say, where I think your district deviates is that the change or the ebb and flow that we usually see is a lot more gradual, not as strongly pronounced. I mean, to lose as many students as you gained in a 7-year period and a 2-year period is not typical. But I also, because it's so atypical, and we've never seen that kind of behavior, I unfortunately can't say that we've witnessed this, that kind of dramatic shift, or at least that kind of deviation from our projection within the first couple of years. Usually they're within a percent, which is standard. But again, your district, I think, is an outlier in so many other ways, and then specifically, like I said, with the multifamily situation, the non-public school enrollment, like I said, that's quite frankly a little bit odd that that's increasing. Lower Marion saw a slight uptick last year, but they're growing by leaps and bounds, for a whole host of other reasons as well. But you have a similar situation as like Lower Marion. You border the city. You are one of the first places that people will look to when they decamp the city in terms of school district. And you are the top, you're in the top 20% of school districts in the city. It's a quality school district, so there's definitely that kind of pull. But I can say that, I know Abington's seen more growth than they were expecting in the last couple of years, and they have this a similar dynamic though too. So it does make me wonder, just how typical Cheltenham is. I don't think it is.
And I guess my final question is in terms of understanding at a more granular level the demographics, socioeconomic, race, all that stuff of the students that have left. Do we have that, or is that not something that's
the students who have left?
Yeah.
That we have.
Yeah.
And definitely that.
I know we saw that.
Those will come. Yeah.
Okay.
So we're trying to get
some of that information for you because we anticipated that that was going to, what does that look like? But we had shared with you what it looked like coming in post-October, post-October 1st. But we also, I also had shared the trend over the last 30 years and what I project if we keep, without as scientific as you are, calculating the percentage increase on average, if we move in that direction, that we're currently 53% African American and 30% Caucasian. In 10 years, we moved to 68% African American and around 20 to 21%. And subsequently, the number of students who are on free reduced lunch, if that trajectory continues to go up, will also go up too, and we'll move from 25% to close to 37, 38. But that is just rough sketching it. It's not scientific. I just built some makeshift algorithm that is not scientific. But it follows the trajectory over the last 30
years. Historical enrollment.
Yeah, over, if the trend continues the way it is, this is what it's gonna look like 10 years from now.
And I said socioeconomic race, but really I guess the root is just in terms of what are the service, if the goal of this is to understand what are projecting over the next 10 years, what are the likely kinds of services we are gonna want to be changing. So
if I can add Dr. Mercedes comment, at the liaison committee meeting, at the liaison group meeting, there was a discussion with the township, and the township has a contract with the planning commission, also with the county, and we're going to be approaching the county planning commission to look at some of the socioeconomic demographic factors going forward to do some projections more formally to try to address some of Dr. Mercedes' points and also some of your points to try to do some analysis to look at things forward on behalf of the township and also for the school district purposes as well.
That's all my questions. Thank you.
Thank you. You answered a lot of my questions.
Sorry.
I just have one. When you look at the 63 new students on that option three progression model, even taking into consideration some of the fluctuations since October 1, let's say we've had another 20 students, we're still looking at K through 4 in terms of that, whatever the final number is spread out over the K through 4 schools versus 5 to 6 or 9 to 12, where we're seeing decrease over that period of time. Am I interpreting that?
Well, no. So the 63 students is actually is grafted onto the, essentially, I could... I can also send this information to you so the point it more out clearly because this can be hard to explain. We graphed it on essentially to each individual projection year. So each grade year in that matrix that you saw, okay, so the historical, there's one of those for the future as well. Okay. And so we graphed it across the entire thing. So it's not an assumption that we're saying, well, there's going to be more of them going into the elementary school, so we do that. We don't try and do that because that's, again, those are assumptions that you can't really base on anything unless you have data that says that most of the people that come into the district as a result of sales do that, and of course no one really has that.
Okay, so then interpreting that, that's really K through 12.
That's, across the entire district. Okay. Yeah, spread evenly.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. That's helpful.
So looking at Little Gardens Towers at Wincote, recognizing that in the footnote here, that the information for the last year, 2018, taken at the start of the school year versus previous years in the school years, for those two properties, the number of children dropped dramatically.
Yes.
For me, somewhat dramatically, and represented probably the bulk of the impact.
Are
on
you
township.
Tell me where you're referencing?
Wait, I'm sorry, page 13.
Oh, thank you.
So I guess several questions around that would be at the top of Little Gardens and also Winkler Towers is the second row. Would be maybe either getting data that's current or after the start of the school year, and or getting data from the 17-18 school
year. I tested
year.
That, actually. I didn't put it in here, because I wanted to keep the nice little intervals we had, but I did look at 17-18, because I saw that, too, and I knew that it was the first year. I figured that's not a one-to-one comparison, so I wanted to see what that trajectory was actually like. And even when looking at 17-18, it was around 479 students coming from Linwood. So even at the end of the year, it still represented a decrease at the end of the year. So if you were to do that, you would probably likely see that with Towers of Wayne Code as well. But also, I mean, it's important to note out, too, that there's a couple of developments here that have also gained in students. They're among the smaller ones, but it's interesting, though, to see that some of the smaller, some of the most oldest apartments that were built in the 50s and 60s are actually attracting families at a greater clip, probably because of their affordability. Mm-hmm.
Right, and that's actually one of the other questions about, I know that the Buckets Park House, that the condominiums there are frankly very affordable.
Yeah.
And the question would be for that building, as an example, would be that there is potential, which is out of our control, for some of these properties that have a limited number of students in them to over time change. Whether it's an apartment complex where either there's marketing forces that help drive that increase, or just market forces that help drive that, or just trends in general that drive those forces that exist, and not to be overly fixated or scared about that, but that's something which is out of our control. And it's interesting, if some of these do grow, some of the smaller ones where it's incremental, over time they could either find out or go down or go up, and it could have exponential over time, have an increase as dramatic, or
it's
maybe
true.
It could be offset with some of the bigger ones if the trends we're starting to see now for Linwood and Winco Towers, if those start to go down, it could even out. So my point is that we really don't know, especially about those units, because there are a range of opportunities that can afford themselves potentially for those multifamily units to really change in terms of their composition,
right,
in terms of school-aged children.
And I will say one thing that I think is, to me, seems kind of anachronistic, is that when we look at condo units versus apartment rentals actually originate more students than owned condos, which I would have assumed the opposite. I would have assumed if you put down roots and you buy a condo, and usually the ones for sale are a lot larger and more family-oriented in size.
This concludes this school board recording. This recording is copyright by KD3HW and is released for free distribution under the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivation 3.0 United States license. Podcast sounds courtesy of freesound.org. See the acknowledgement page of the podcast website. Thank you for downloading us, and have a great day.